Chapter 2. The Great Bacteria Hunt. The leading killers in the industrial world today are the slow-developing conditions of older age, including heart disease, osteoporosis, Alzheimer's disease, and cancer. As our health and life expectancies increase, the more lives these diseases will claim. But people throughout the Third World and in our own past have faced death at much younger ages and from a different cause, contagious disease. Pre-industrial societies are marked by frequent and deadly epidemics of every conceivable infectious illness, from flus and pneumonias to tuberculosis and smallpox. Although infectious disease was commonplace in earlier times, people were mystified by these strange conditions that could be passed from one individual to another. Thus, during the many centuries in which infections dominated human mortality, myths ranging from possession by evil spirits to inhalation of miasmal airs were offered as explanations. Not until the 17th century did the first person use lens-making technology to discover the existence of microbes. Antony van Leeuwenhoek, a Dutch janitor with a penchant for constructing microscopes in his spare time, found immense numbers of the tiny, one-celled organisms now known as bacteria in saliva. The tiny creatures existed not only in bodies of humans and animals, but even in the water of rivers and lakes. Leeuwenhoek's discovery did attract the attention of established scientists at the time, but he never supposed that these bacteria might cause disease and considered them mere curiosities. Nor had he any reason to blame them for disease, because no logical rules yet existed for proving such an idea. 2 centuries later, Leeuwenhoek's discovery did give birth to the germ theory of disease. A French chemistry professor named Louis Pasteur was asked by local brewers to determine why some vats fermented and others did not. He learned through his experiments that yeast, a microbial type of fungus, was the organism making the alcohol, and that bacteria could prevent the fermentation as well as cause contaminated food to decompose. Physicians and scientists throughout Europe soon made the logical connection with disease, and the hypothesis that such germs might cause sickness became a widespread topic of discussion. Joseph Lister, for example, gained prominence as the doctor who popularized antiseptic surgical techniques in the wake of Pasteur's growing fame. And Ignaz Semmelweis from the University of Vienna correctly deduced that washed hands and germ-free clothes eliminated childbed fever. Still, no one had actually proven that a particular infectious disease was caused by a corresponding bacterium. Many leading doctors, in fact, refused to believe that disease could result from transmissible microbes at all. Although they ultimately turned out to be mistaken, their healthy skepticism nonetheless played a critical scientific role, forcing the early microbe hunters to formulate objective standards for blaming any disease on a germ. The importance of such proof cannot be underestimated. Many diseases are not infectious, yet a number have been falsely blamed on harmless passenger microbes throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. Such mistakes can be easily avoided only when scientists carefully apply logical standards. By 1840, Jakob Henle, a professor at Germany's Göttingen University, publicly suggested that infectious disease would be found to be the result of some invisible living organism that could be transmitted from person to person. The problem, as Henle observed, was that to prove this contagion caused a disease, it would have to be isolated and grown outside the human body. At the University of Prague, another German professor named Edwin Klebs carried this reasoning one step further during the 1870s. Not only should the microbe be cultured from the diseased body, but it should be able to cause the same disease when injected into another animal. To many European doctors, this proposal certainly made logical sense. But without any examples proven by such experiments, most doctors preferred to suspend judgment on the germ theory. At this point, a German medical doctor named Robert Koch entered the fray. He founded his research on the results of Casimir Joseph Devan of France, who had demonstrated that blood from cows with anthrax could transfer the disease to newly injected cows. Studying the strain of bacterium found most easily in cattle with anthrax, Koch wanted to prove his suggestion that the microbes could spread disease. He was, therefore, forced to find some way to grow them under his microscope. He developed a method of growing the bacteria in the eye fluid from slaughtered cattle and quickly proved his point. Koch inoculated mice with these bacterial cultures and discovered that they too became sick as their bodies filled with the deadly bacteria. Having initially planned to study bacteria merely for their own sake, he instead published a paper in 1876 boldly announcing he had proved this bacillus to be the cause of anthrax. Koch thus became the first person to meet the criteria of Edwin Klebs. However, the anthrax bacteria were large and easy to isolate, and they usually cause disease in animals rather than humans. So he next followed his growing interest in the subject of human disease and started his work with the study of open wound infections. Observing samples from various animals and people, he reported that bacteria could hardly be found in healthy organisms while they were abundant in the blood of the diseased animals. Koch's results led him to add now a third and key condition to the others proposed by Klebs. In order to prove that bacteria are the cause of traumatic infective diseases, it would be absolutely necessary to show that bacteria are present without exception and that their number and distribution are such that the symptoms of the disease are fully explained. In other words, a microbe cannot scientifically be proved guilty of causing a disease unless every diseased individual has large amounts of the germ growing in the damaged tissues of the body. A single exception would be enough to pronounce the microbe innocent of creating that disease. One major problem with meeting such standards of proof lay in the difficulty of culturing pure preparations of any given bacterial species. Koch's 1878 book on his wound infection experiments described his attempts to purify the cultures so that contaminating bacteria could not be blamed for causing the disease. But only in 1881 did he finally publish a paper describing a new technique for pure culture of bacteria. The method used a dish, later improved and named the Petri dish after Koch's assistant, that allowed scientists easily to separate or clone individual bacteria by growing them apart from one another. Finally, the microbe hunting tools, both experimental and logical, were in place. However, the appeal to find even individual microbes in a patient with Koch's new method turned out to be a mixed blessing. Many of Koch's followers triumphantly claimed bacterial causes of non-bacterial, even non-infectious diseases without ever checking the titer or number of bacteria in these diseases. Many of these putative microbial pathogens later proved to be harmless passenger microbes, normal parasites of healthy and ill persons when subjected to Koch's postulates for criteria to distinguish harmless from pathogenic microbes. The problem of confounding harmless with pathogenic microbes has reached epidemic proportions in recent history as hypersensitive molecular techniques have been invented that allow the detection of dormant, dead, and even defective viruses or microbes. Koch next focused his attention on tuberculosis, the leading infectious killer of humans at that time. Within months, he found isolated and cultured a bacterium from the patients. According to Koch, in all tissues in which the tuberculosis process has recently developed and is progressing most rapidly, these bacilli can be found in large numbers. As soon as the peak of the tubercle eruption has passed, the bacilli become rarer. Having met the first two conditions of proof, he went on to show that guinea pigs injected with the purified bacteria would now become sick with tuberculosis. The proof complete, Koch published his landmark 1882 paper describing the experiments. He wrote another key paper on tuberculosis in 1884 in which he spelled out the three criteria for proving a microbe guilty of causing a disease. First, the germ must be found growing abundantly in every patient and every diseased tissue. Second, the germ must be isolated and grown in the laboratory. Third, the purified germ must cause the disease again in another host. Together, these rules have become known as Koch's postulates. Fame quickly followed Koch's work, and scientists and doctors alike jumped on the bandwagon. During the next two decades, bacteria were found and proven guilty of inducing more than a dozen major diseases, including diphtheria, tetanus, food poisoning, some types of pneumonia, and syphilis. But in the rush and popularity of the new microbe hunting, a scientific sloppiness led many researchers to blame newly discovered bacteria prematurely without having satisfied the universally accepted postulates of Koch. Even Koch himself was partly guilty, for he too maintained an overly enthusiastic ambition to find bacteria in almost every disease. In his study of cholera, for example, he isolated the correct bacterium, but could not find an animal that would become sick when injected with the microbe. He nevertheless declared it the cause of cholera using statistical correlations rather than testing other animal species to meet the third postulate. Unable to distinguish an animal that was vaccinated by natural infection from one that was susceptible, Koch may have tested his cholera bacteria in immune animals. At this time, microbe hunters were just beginning to understand how vaccination works. Since immunology was in its infancy, Koch never used artificial vaccination as a reverse means of conducting the test, for example, rendering an animal resistant to a microbe by vaccination. As it turns out, scientists have since produced cholera in rabbits, dogs, and guinea pigs, though in unimmunized animals. While Koch was lucky on that score, he and others soon made numerous mistakes in identifying disease-causing bacteria. But the successes did lead to a variety of developments in medical technologies, including the discovery of antibiotics for killing bacteria, the development of new vaccines against various microbes, and an increased emphasis on hygiene. Governments began enforcing public sanitation and vaccination measures mostly after Koch's appointment to the Imperial Health Office of Germany, policies that soon spread throughout the industrializing world. Nutrition and standards of living also improved among industrial nations during the same time period. While controversy exists over the importance of each condition in stopping particular epidemics, the epidemics as such have largely disappeared, and medical intervention against the microbes is widely credited for this. Indeed, no other medical discovery has ever achieved as much acclaim. Naturally, then, scientists have since kept an ambitious eye out for new microbes, hoping to find the causes of unexplained diseases, often the ticket to fame and fortune. But when scientific standards such as Koch's postulates have been pushed aside in the race for recognition, medical disasters have usually struck. Humans and animals, whether healthy or sick, are host to many hundreds of microbes, the great majority of which cause no harm whatsoever. Some can even be beneficial, such as the E. coli bacteria that populate the intestines and aid digestion. Without the rigor of the scientific method, researchers can easily isolate one of these harmless microbes and blame it for a disease, even if the illness is non-infectious. Plagues of malnutrition. As we know today, scurvy is a disease caused by a lack of vitamin C in the diet. It begins with such characteristic symptoms as bleeding gums, progresses to swollen legs, and brain-destroying dementia, and ultimately leads to death. Long before vitamin C was chemically identified and isolated in the 1930s, various observant individuals had noticed that scurvy could be cured even in its latest stages by some anti-scorbutic factor found in such foods as citrus fruits, potatoes, milk, and fresh meat. But the historic preoccupation with contagious disease often obscured this discovery, each time delaying public knowledge of the health benefits of such foods for many more years. Fear of contagion predates Robert Koch's discovery of disease-causing bacteria. During the mid-16th century, roughly 100 years before Antony von Leeuwenhoek first saw microbes in his primitive microscope, scurvy was given its first description by physicians that included Roncius, an advocate of a dietary hypothesis of the disease. His contemporary, Ecthius, on the other hand, watched outbreaks of scurvy among monks in a single monastery and concluded the disease was infectious. This latter opinion proved influential for centuries despite an early proof of diet as the cause. Sir Richard Hawkins, a British admiral, confronted scurvy among his sailors on a long voyage in 1593. Upon reaching Brazil, he discovered that eating oranges and lemons would cure the condition. Nevertheless, even he felt obligated partly to blame unsanitary shipboard conditions, and following his death, the British Navy completely lost all memory of the citrus fruit cure. While Hawkins still lived, a Frenchman named François Perrault described an expedition to the East Indies. Unaware of Hawkins's findings, he ascribed scurvy to a want of cleanliness and insisted that it is very contagious even by approaching or breathing another's breath. Yet Perrault, ironically, had also discovered the curative power of citrus fruits. His independent dietary discovery was forgotten, as was Hawkins's, and the infectious view continued to prevail. An outbreak of scurvy occurred on a 1734 voyage of a British ship, affecting one sailor especially severely. Anxious to prevent spread of what he believed to be a contagious disease, the captain marooned the hardest-hit sailor on the nearest island. Fortunately for the sailor, he ate grass, snails, and later shellfish, from which he received enough vitamin C to recover. A passing ship found him, and upon reaching England, he astonished many by the very fact that he lived. This was one of the events that stimulated James Lind, British naval surgeon, to begin his experimentation in curing scurvy. After several years of research, he concluded that the key to the cure and prevention of scurvy was some factor found in citrus fruits, but missing from sailors' diets. He published this proof as a book in 1753, but he was roundly rejected by the British medical establishment for some 40 years. Only in 1795 was lemon juice finally provided to naval sailors, at that time often called lime juice, thus originating the nickname limeys for sailors. During this period, the English captain James Cook also discovered on his 1769 voyage that fresh vegetables and citrus fruits worked, despite no apparent knowledge of Lind's work. But he too insisted on hygienic practices and fresh air, which he believed to be as important as diet in preventing scurvy, thereby helping to confuse the significance of his results. By the turn of the 19th century, the point seemingly should have been settled. However, the role of diet had never been fully accepted outside of England, and even British doctors gradually reduced their emphasis on it as the century progressed. This negligence, combined with the rise of bacteria hunting in the later 1800s, led too many scientists to forget or ignore the earlier discoveries. One could more easily isolate a new bacterium than a new vitamin. Jean-Antoine Velleman provided one prominent example. A member of the Paris Academy of Medicine, he was the first to demonstrate that tuberculosis was an infectious disease. Robert Koch had based his search for the tuberculosis bacillus on this work. Velleman became a passionate advocate of the germ theory for disease in general, and in 1874 began debating the still widely accepted view that bad diet was somehow responsible for scurvy. In one paraphrased version, he states, "Scurvy is a contagious miasm, comparable to typhus, which occurs in epidemic form when people are closely congregated in large groups, as in prisons, naval vessels, and sieges. We have many examples of well-fed sailors and soldiers going down with scurvy, while others less well-fed do not. Also, we have positive evidence of the spread of the disease by contagion, for example, the introduction of scurvy into French military hospitals by veterans returning from the Crimea, and the rapid spread of scurvy from one sailor to another in naval vessels." Velleman, of course, was using a poor argument that nonetheless is still repeated today by top scientists for other diseases. Outbreaks of a disease do not really argue for an infectious cause, merely for a factor common to the group in which the disease appears. Another member of the Academy of Medicine responded to Velleman by arguing that some diet common to the afflicted was indeed the reason for those scurvy epidemics. Further, he pointed out the danger of falsely blaming a disease on infection. Medical authorities would justifiably see the need to quarantine patients to protect the public. The growing popularity of the germ theory and its clear successes soon gripped medicine so tightly that it began redirecting research on scurvy. In 1899, British explorer Frederick Jackson teamed up with a professor at London University to perform experiments on the disease in animals. Jackson decided that fresh meat did not contain a vitamin, but rather that older meat was contaminated with bacteria that spoiled it and produced ptomaines, poisons that would cause scurvy. Joseph Lister, the surgeon inspired by Pasteur's discoveries enough to popularize antiseptic surgery to avoid infections, had by this time become president of the Royal Society of London and was only too happy to provide funding for Jackson's research. As he himself put it, he wished to see new research on scurvy in light of the recent microbe discoveries. The two researchers chose monkeys for their experiment, feeding them various diets to see whether diet itself or food contamination would induce scurvy. But since vitamin C had not yet been isolated, the diets were not well controlled for the postulated food factor, and the results showed that monkeys fed tainted meat became sick more often. The president of the Royal Society endorsed and promoted the experimental report, and microbe hunters believing scurvy to result from digestive tract infection and intent on finding a guilty bacterium seized on the report in an attempt to silence diet-minded critics. The obsession with microbe hunting not only distracted scientists from finding vitamin C, but actually helped cause epidemics of scurvy. For instance, Louis Pasteur's technique of sterilizing milk by heating it had spread throughout Europe and America, becoming popular because the microbe hunters had convinced the public of hygiene's primary importance. The pasteurization process, unfortunately, also tended to destroy the vitamin C in milk, which led to hundreds of new scurvy cases among young children each year. Unwilling to admit their mistake or to read the available history of the disease, the American Pediatric Association issued a report on childhood scurvy in 1898, concluding that bacteria-produced ptomaine poisoning, not the heating of milk, was the real cause of the epidemic. Researchers simply would not let go of the germ theory in their scurvy research. A popular textbook, Osler's Modern Medicine, while recognizing some dietary role in the disease, insisted in 1907 that an unidentified microbe contaminating the food must infect the unsuspecting victim and cause the sickness. Another contemporary view held the disease to be a type of inherited syphilis, itself a genuine bacterial disease. One French scientist actually found a new strain of bacteria in a scorbutic baby and proposed it to be the cause, although other scientists examining the blood of other patients could not find the bacterium. During World War I, another group of scientists isolated a different bacterium from scorbutic guinea pigs and still another from an adult human. The bacilli found in the animals was then injected into healthy guinea pigs, some of which developed symptoms vaguely resembling scurvy. But the bacteria could never be found in the blood of these newly infected animals, and blood from a sick animal would not make another animal sick when injected. Still, the researchers argued they had the scurvy-causing germ. Another report at that time proposed that scurvy could be transmitted through lice. Many or most doctors in Russia, meanwhile, believed bacteria to be the cause, as did various surgeons in other European armies. And at least one German doctor, sent in 1916 to examine Russian soldiers suffering from scurvy, largely blamed their unsanitary conditions. Of course, all of the germs blamed for scurvy failed to meet Koch's postulates, standards that could have prevented much of the wasted effort, but scientists were busier trying to emulate Koch's success rather than his rigorous logic. Fortunately, the microbe hunting craze did not permanently derail the search for vitamin C, which was finally purified by the 1930s. C.P. Stewart, professor of clinical chemistry at the University of Edinburgh, in 1953 summarized the chronic scurvy disaster. One factor which undoubtedly held up the development of the concept of deficiency diseases was the discovery of bacteria in the 19th century and the consequent preoccupation of scientists and doctors with positive infective agents in disease. So strong was the impetus provided by bacteriology that many diseases which we now know to be due to nutritional or endocrine deficiencies were as late as 1910 thought to be toxemias. In default of any evidence of an active infecting microorganism, they were ascribed to the remote effects of imaginary toxins elaborated by bacteria. Beriberi is a fatal condition brought on by a dietary lack of vitamin B, thiamine. The nervous system degenerates, creating paralysis, swelling, and often heart attacks. Though it has primarily plagued Asia throughout history, it appeared with a vengeance in the West after the French Revolution, when the French population rejected the dark bread of peasantry in favor of the royal milled white bread from which the thiamine had been unknowingly removed. Bread processing soon swept throughout Europe and the United States, and beriberi followed closely. The first person to discover the basic cause of the condition was Kenihiro Takaki, a medical doctor and later surgeon general for the Japanese Navy. Concerned about the beriberi epidemic rampant in the Japanese military and in the cities, he carefully studied its characteristics and during the 1880s performed an experiment. By experimenting with the diets of sailors in different ships, he found he could cure and even prevent the disease. The military, responding decisively, altered the official diet for sailors and thereby ended the epidemic in 1885. Takaki then published his persuasive results in the British medical journal Lancet in 1887. Instead of acknowledging poor nutrition as the cause of beriberi, the scientific community wantonly disregarded it. The report had arrived during the height of the bacteria hunting craze, 5 years after Robert Koch had found the tuberculosis bacillus, and microbe hunters were eager to find new germs. Even in Japan, microbe hunters strongly influenced by Koch and his contemporaries sniped at Takaki, insisting that beriberi was truly infectious and had been cured by better sanitation, not by better diet. Christian Eichmann, a Dutch army doctor, had meanwhile observed firsthand an epidemic of beriberi among the Dutch soldiers in Java. Although the disease mysteriously left the natives alone while ravaging the conscientiously hygienic Dutch, Eichmann's infection-biased medical training led him to assume some germ must cause the disease. He therefore decided to advance his skills in finding bacteria and spent a few months, 1885 to 1886, working in Robert Koch's laboratory in Berlin. Having become desperate, the Dutch colonial administration in the meantime formed a team of scientists under Dr. Pekelharing to study the disease. Pekelharing also assumed the condition was infectious, and after consulting Koch, recruited Eichmann onto the team. In Java, Pekelharing isolated a bacterium that he promptly blamed for beriberi. He left shortly thereafter, turning over his work to the enthusiastic microbe hunter Eichmann. But Eichmann, unable to find the microbe in all the sick patients, tried at least to transmit the disease to chickens through blood from patients. At first, nothing happened. Then all the chickens developed a sickness like beriberi, including those not having received any blood. Confused, he performed several other experiments until he discovered that the sickness was caused by eating polished rice, which had temporarily been fed to the chickens instead of their usual unprocessed rice. This explained the human disease. The Dutch all ate polished rice, while the Javan natives did not. Eichmann convinced the Dutch prison warden in Java to test the idea by feeding unrefined rice to the prisoners. Their beriberi soon disappeared. Upon presenting his results to his supervisor, Eichmann received only rejection. His superior even went so far as to publish an attack on the chicken and prison studies, and when Eichmann published his own paper in 1890, colleagues criticized him. The Dutch commission to which Eichmann belonged officially concluded that, although blame could not be fixed on the Pekelharing bacillus, the epidemic must be caused by an undiscovered germ. Eichmann himself was so under the hypnotic spell of the germ theory that he continued for at least 8 more years to refer to beriberi as a contagious disease caused by microbes, despite his own results. The peer pressure of scientific consensus must also have intimidated him. At least 24 of his colleagues continued to find and blame the sickness on a dizzying variety of microbes, ranging from bacteria to worms. Scientists isolated bacteria from the digestive system, blood, and urine of beriberi patients. One group found 3 types of bacteria and blamed them all. Another investigative team discovered 4 types simultaneously. 3 groups blamed protozoa, organisms similar to the one causing malaria, and at least 2 scientists decided fungi growing on moldy rice were the culprits. Even a virus was reported found and falsely convicted in 1900. No single microbe remained popular for long, however, largely because a fair number of scientists failed in trying to find each germ in all beriberi patients, and they were willing to publish their negative results. Robert Koch himself ironically held high hopes of finding the beriberi bacillus, but was unsuccessful during his research on a trip to New Guinea. Koch's careful commitment to logical scientific standards overrode his enthusiasm, and he openly published his lack of results in 1900. Nevertheless, reports of beriberi causing microbes actually continued after 1910, and the predominant infectious view of the disease led doctors to treat it with such compounds as quinine, arsenic, and strychnine. The question of beriberi's cause was finally settled only when vitamin B was isolated in 1911 and again in 1926. The vitamin is now added back to white bread, and beriberi has become a rare disease. Robert Williams, one of the scientists who pioneered the discovery of vitamin B1, later commented on the dangerous influence of the microbe hunters in emulating Pasteur and Koch too carelessly. Because of the work of Pasteur and Koch and other dramatic successes, bacteriology had advanced within 20 years after its birth to become the chief cornerstone of medical education. All young physicians were so imbued with the idea of infection as the cause of disease that it presently came to be accepted as almost axiomatic that disease could have no other cause. This preoccupation of physicians with infection as a cause of disease was doubtless responsible for many digressions from attention to food as the causal factor of beriberi. The Pellagra Plague. In terms of the number of people affected, pellagra has probably been the most devastating vitamin deficiency epidemic of all. It manifests itself most visibly by rough and peeling skin, with splotches of reddish pigmentation, followed by nerve disorders and dementia, wasting syndrome and diarrhea, and finally, death. First described in the 18th century, the disease soon grew into an epidemic in Italy and spread throughout the Mediterranean area during the 19th century. The name pellagra derives from the Italian for rough skin. As was discovered earlier in this century, niacin deficiency is the cause. Because corn lacks niacin and various populations have turned to corn as a nearly complete substitute for other vegetables, pellagra has usually appeared wherever corn has become a dietary mainstay. Doctors who wrote the early descriptions of the disease clearly noticed the association with corn diets and poverty. Beginning in the early 1800s, a series of physicians formulated several closely related hypotheses about this connection, speculating either that corn itself caused pellagra or that the fungus on moldy corn produced some sort of poison. Some prescient observers even correctly guessed that corn was not nutritious enough as a complete diet. But most European doctors originally agreed that the syndrome could not be contagious, since it never seriously spread out of the impoverished corn-eating subpopulations. Already in the 1700s, several physicians blamed the disease on miasms or bad airs, and as early as the 1790s, a doctor on occasion would observe that pellagrins, pellagra patients, could be cured with more balanced eating habits. Despite the clear inability of the disease to spread beyond the risk groups, some doctors unfamiliar with the disease still proposed it to be contagious. The German doctor Titius himself, far removed from epidemic areas in 1791, simply called it infectious. Prominent French doctor Jean-Marie Hameau, in his 1853 doctoral thesis, decided that since pellagra strikes people living near sheep and sheep have an infectious disease with some symptoms resembling pellagra, the disease was transmitted from sheep. Barring this unlikely possibility, Hameau conceded the infection might come from contaminated corn. Although most doctors did not agree with Hameau's view, a typical approach to treating pellagra was nevertheless based on fighting infection, which included artificial bleeding, quinine, and arsenic. The latter in particular was the treatment pioneered by one of the early Italian microbe hunters, who believed the common fungus on moldy corn caused the disease. As the successes of Pasteur and Koch became widely popular, scientists and doctors began flocking into bacteriology. No longer required to invent hypothetical microbes, they could use Koch's simple tools for isolating real bacteria and blame them for the disease. Many wanted to have Koch's success, but few were willing to apply the acid test of Koch's postulates, nor even to ask whether the disease in question was truly contagious, as evidenced by spreading out of its initial risk groups. Thus, bacteria hunting turned to pellagra with a vengeance. In 1881, the Italian doctor Miocchi was first to isolate a bacterium from both spoiled corn and the blood of patients. Several more scientists discovered that this microbe was the same as a previously identified bacterium found in potatoes, and that the rotten mass of corn contaminated by this germ could cause diarrhea in dogs, though not in other animals. However, unlike Miocchi, they could not find the bacterium in the blood of pellagrins, instead finding it growing in the intestines of all humans, including those without disease. So ended Miocchi's bacterium. Another bacterium, reported in 1896 by Caroli, was also soon abandoned. Then for several years after the turn of the century, an Italian researcher named Cene generated a remarkable number of scientific papers claiming that a corn fungus excreted by chickens, regardless of whether the fowl had eaten fresh or spoiled corn, also caused the disease in humans. Cene and his co-workers found these fungal spores in most but not all people who had died of pellagra and tested a variety of animals to show that large amounts of this fungus would make the animals sick, especially when injected into the blood. Cheney soon expanded his list to 2 and then 4 separate fungi that he thought would all cause pellagra. Even though these fungi could not grow in the body, Cheney insisted they could still release poisons. During these years, Caroli, who had previously isolated a bacterium from pellagrins, now jumped on the fungus bandwagon, alleging that one of Cheney's fungi could be isolated from the fecal matter, urine, blood, saliva, and affected skin of patients. By injecting the fungus into experimental animals, he even produced symptoms he thought resembled pellagra. In fact, Caroli was so caught up in admiring this microbe that he simultaneously accused it of causing syphilis. Another researcher inspired by Cheney reported in 1904 2 new candidate bacteria for causing pellagra based on their presence in corn and resistance to the heat of cooking. One of these could cause intestinal sickness when injected into animals. The other was similar to the intestinal bacterium present in all humans that helps digest food, so he decided it released poisons that could act as cofactors or enhancers in helping Cheney's fungi cause pellagra. The sheer volume of Cheney's ongoing research forced a number of scientists to spend a great deal of effort refuting his results. The fungal spores, as it turned out, neither caused pellagra nor any other disease in animals, nor could they be found in patients having died of the disease. And the full-grown fungi were often simply natural parasites of humans. Yet the microbe hunt continued. Tizzoni, a prominent Italian researcher and doctor, began reporting from 1906 onward for several years his experiments on 2 strains of bacteria, both blamed by him for pellagra. Having found the germs in pellagrins, he and other scientists were able to cause some sort of sickness in monkeys and guinea pigs injected with the bacteria. Thus, he brazenly declared, "It would seem to be settled that pellagra is a bacterial disease." However, a number of scientists never could isolate these bacteria from people with pellagra, leaving Tizzoni's work with little impact among European doctors stymied in trying to cure the disease. The chances of finding a cure, as well as the opportunities for microbe hunters, multiplied dramatically once the pellagra epidemic appeared in the United States. A few cases had passed unnoticed before the 20th century, but the first recognized instance appeared in Georgia when a single farmer was diagnosed by his doctor with the disease in 1902. 4 years passed without the medical establishment paying any attention. Then an outbreak suddenly appeared at a hospital for the insane in Alabama. 88 patients became severely ill, most of whom died. Soon dozens of cases began appearing in hospitals throughout southern states and even in Illinois. Facing a now unnerving epidemic, the head of a hospital for the insane in South Carolina visited Italy in 1908 and decisively concluded that the American epidemic was indeed pellagra. By mid-1909, hundreds of cases had occurred in more than a dozen states. The Public Health Service, a branch of the federal government that still exists today, established a small laboratory for pellagra research in South Carolina. Their man in charge, Claude Lavender, pursued 3 lines of activity: experiments, therapy, and public relations. Having no other serious model to follow, he searched for a microbial cause of the disease by injecting various types of animals with bodily fluids from pellagrins, though to no avail. None of the animals became sick. Lavender's treatments fared no better, for he used the widely popular arsenic as well as mercury. But his propaganda efforts proved more effective, for the media soon mobilized to convince Americans they were facing a disease that could spread out of control and that would affect everyone, rich and poor alike. The growing epidemic activated the concern of many medical doctors, who in 1909 held a national conference on pellagra in South Carolina. As in Europe, the evidence of pellagra's association with corn-based diets was clearly recognized at the meeting, as was the fact that it struck exclusively poor communities. Soon thereafter, blacks were recognized as the major risk group, both facts indicating a non-contagious epidemic. But the age of microbe hunting was still in full swing, and although many scientists began instigating the corn connection, the conference also set in motion a revived hunt for a pellagra microbe. The following year, Lavender was replaced at the pellagra lab by John D. Long, who believed the disease was brought on through a lack of hygiene. He discovered an amoebal microbe in the intestines of most of his pellagra patients and fingered this germ as the cause in his 1910 report. Long, as it turned out, had followed the lead of Louis Sambon, a well-known British doctor who, in 1905, had announced after a brief visit to Italy that he believed pellagra to be an infectious disease. Building on his own work on malaria, Sambon declared to the press in 1910 that the disease was transmitted by insects, either flies or buffalo gnats. He failed to notice that, unlike malaria, pellagra did not spread out of its risk groups, even in epidemic areas. Only very poor farmers were affected. Sambon did realize that an infectious disease should spread at least somewhat and therefore argued erroneously that children were primary targets of the disease. Because of his own reputation and the fact that he had assembled an official commission of top British doctors, Sambon's hypothesis caught on and quickly spread to the United States. One scientist, convinced of the Sambon hypothesis, published evidence in 1912 that airborne insects crowded the areas near water during the seasons pellagra was most prevalent, implying a malaria-like spread of pellagra. Another research team created a complex hypothesis of insect transmission in Kentucky, reasoning that insects picked up the deadly microbe from horses, transferred it to blackbirds that flew to other areas where more insects now carried the germ to unsuspecting humans. Meanwhile, at least two other prominent doctors actually isolated protozoa from many but not all pellagrins and published these as either causes or cofactors. Even the Department of Agriculture sent a special team of entomologists to study insects in South Carolina in 1912. Potential transmission routes ranging from contaminated drinking water to mosquitoes, even houseflies and bedbugs, were suspected as vectors carrying pellagra, and newspaper articles served to fan public fears as the epidemic grew, not unlike our modern response to the AIDS epidemic. So great was the horror of the disease that a diagnosis of pellagra was synonymous with a sentence of ostracism. A severe case of eczema was enough to start a stampede in a community, and pellagrins sometimes covered their hands with gloves or salve, hoping to conceal their condition. Many hospitals refused admission to pellagra patients. One in Atlanta did so on the grounds that it was an incurable disease. At another hospital in the same city, student nurses went on strike when they were required to nurse pellagrins. Physicians and nurses at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore were forbidden even to discuss pellagra cases, which might be there. Fear of the disease spread to schools and hotels, too. Tennessee began to isolate all its pellagra patients. The State Board of Health declared pellagra to be a transmissible disease and required physicians to report all cases. Exhibits on pellagra were prepared for the public, creating fear of the disease along with interest in it. There was pressure for a quarantine in Kentucky, and pellagra patients at the Western Kentucky Asylum for the Insane were isolated. Isolation did not prevent spread of pellagra, but instead heightened panic over it. A second national conference on pellagra was organized in South Carolina in 1912, and this time the momentum of scientific and medical thought had turned in favor of finding pellagra germs. Earlier that same year, an official federal government commission, the Thompson-McFadden Commission, was created and began studies in the South. One of its three leaders was an Army Medical Corps man who had previously served on Louis Sambon's pellagra commission in England. Not surprisingly, the commission showed a complete bias for infectious causes. Quickly and casually dismissing dietary connections, the commission turned its attention to studies of sewage, insect transmission, bacteria, fungi, and even the suggestion that Italian immigrants had brought the disease with them. Ultimately, the stable fly was officially blamed by the commission for spreading the deadly contagion. The prestige of this federal commission spurred the Public Health Service to renew its own effort at finding the pellagra microbe in 1913. Lavender was reassigned to head a group that once again tried in vain to give monkeys the disease from injections of human blood. Yet even then, Lavender could not completely let go of the infection hypothesis, and eventually he gave up pellagra research altogether. Finally, as the epidemic reached the 200,000 victim mark during 1914, and while the Thompson-McFadden Commission continued to issue its reports, the Public Health Service replaced Lavender with an obscure officer named Dr. Joseph Goldberger as head of their team. This was the turning point in the epidemic. Within weeks of arriving in the South, Goldberger saw something the entire medical establishment and its experts, obsessed with microbes, had failed to notice. Venturing both into rural areas and insane asylums to see the victims firsthand, he was astonished to find that even where many patients were concentrated, their doctors and nurses did not catch pellagra. He also observed the different diets of the two groups, the doctors eating meat and vegetables and the farmers their customary corn diets. Goldberger drew the inescapable conclusion. Some nutritional deficiency was the cause. After publicly stating the hypothesis in 1914, he was attacked by doctors who insisted the disease was contagious. Gathering the proof for his notion through a series of experiments in which he completely cured pellagra by changing diets in orphanages, hospitals, and prisons, Goldberger announced his findings in 1915. The New York Times carried the story, although on its inside pages. At a medical conference where the leaders of the Thompson-McFadden Commission presented further findings on infection, Goldberger stirred up intense anger and controversy by critiquing the commission's latest study. When he then presented his own results, the effect was electrifying. Two leading advocates of the contagion view backed down, one of them a leader of the Thompson-McFadden Commission, the other withdrawing his own paper from submission. But when the news media began giving Goldberger's results favorable publicity, pellagra microbe hunters reacted with alarm and anger. Prominent doctors joined in a growing chorus of protest against the supposedly dangerous nutrition hypothesis, arguing that the public was now being misled. One such doctor at a medical conference drew applause when he described as pernicious the newspaper publicity that told people there was no danger of pellagra except from poor food and cooking. The Thompson-McFadden Commission struck back especially hard in 1916 in the pages of medical journals as well as in the New York Times. They reiterated their conclusions, including the dangers of insects. Goldberger patiently confronted his critics and answered their objections, but finally reached a point of exasperation. He decided to perform a new experiment to prove the disease non-infectious. He, his wife, and 14 co-workers injected themselves with samples of blood, feces, mucus, and other bodily fluids from pellagra patients. As he expected, none contracted pellagra. Even this experiment had little effect on medical opinion. Opponents continued to attack or ignore him for several more years, their ranks only gradually thinning with time. Part of the problem lay in pellagra's increasing human toll until the early 1930s, when diets finally began changing to include greater variety. Goldberger continued studying the disease until his death in 1929. Niacin, the vitamin missing in pellagran diets, was isolated in the mid-1930s. The last stand of the bacteria hunters. By the 1930s, the era of bacterial hunting was rapidly drawing to a close. Improved nutrition had improved everybody's immunity, and improved immunity in turn had reduced disease from microbial infection. Today, infectious disease constitutes only about 1% of all causes of death in the industrial world. Public fear of contagion evaporated along with the epidemics, and the microbe hunters were forced into relative obscurity for a time. But today the bacteria hunt is enjoying a modest revival, largely in the wake of the virus hunting era that currently dominates biomedical research. Syphilis is one example. This is a genuinely infectious venereal disease, first causing genital sores called cankers and often spreading from there throughout the body in secondary stages, thereby causing a limited variety of symptoms in different patients. From this ability, the disease acquired the unjustified name, the Great Masquerader. A bacterium was isolated for syphilis in 1905 that fully meets Koch's postulates for causing the disease. Along with the earlier well-defined symptoms of syphilis, scientists identified an additional stage known as neurosyphilis, in which the bacterium would supposedly invade the central nervous system, including the brain, years after the original infection and disease. This later manifestation of the disease results in dementia and insanity. However, if dated from the time of infection, this dementia stage develops only after long incubation periods, and syphilis bacteria cannot be isolated in large numbers from the central nervous system even once these symptoms appear. And infected monkeys have never shown neurosyphilis. Neurosyphilis has also suddenly died out in humans once treatment was switched from arsenic compounds in the 1950s to penicillin. The bacterium, therefore, does not seem to meet Koch's postulates for this particular disease stage. A better explanation of neurosyphilis may lie, ironically, in the treatment itself. Throughout the 19th century, the therapy of choice was mercury, the poisonous heavy metal known to cause nerve and brain damage, especially over long time periods. After the discovery of the syphilis bacterium, doctors began switching their treatment to arsenic-derived compounds developed by Paul Ehrlich and dubbed magic bullets. Arsenic treatments, however, were not without complications either. Only after the introduction of penicillin rather than mercury and arsenic to treat syphilis in the 1950s, and with it the decline of neurosyphilis, did it become apparent that doctors had been mistakenly confusing the poisonous effects of these chemicals with syphilis itself. Since the introduction of penicillin, mercury and arsenic treatments are no longer used, and neurosyphilis has become medical history. But this long-standing belief in the ability of the syphilis bacterium to cause dementia years after infection continues to fascinate scientists. Some researchers who raise questions about the true cause of AIDS, for example, have offered the notion that AIDS might be a disguised form of syphilis, or at least that this might explain AIDS dementia. But AIDS may not be infectious at all. Legionnaire's disease. Undoubtedly, the most spectacular modern bacterial epidemic in America has been Legionnaire's disease, which received an inordinate share of media and official medical attention despite serious questions about the disease itself. The original incident occurred about 2 weeks after the nation's 1976 bicentennial celebration at the Pennsylvania Convention of the American Legion. The convention was headquartered in the Bellevue Stratford Hotel in Philadelphia. Within days after the 4,000-plus conventioneers had disbanded and returned home, many of them began showing up in hospitals throughout the state with severe, sometimes lethal, pneumonias. The entire epidemic ended within a few more days, leaving 182 casualties, including 29 deaths. A special team of investigators from the Federal Centers for Disease Control, CDC, spent the next 5 months trying to isolate the germ responsible. None of more than 50 known viruses, bacteria, fungi, or protozoa could be found in all the victims, but that December, one CDC lab researcher discovered a previously unknown bacterium in tissue samples from some of the patients. The CDC immediately declared the microbe guilty of causing Legionnaire's disease, taxonomically designating it Legionella pneumophila. According to their hypothesis, the bacteria had infected the Legionnaires through the air conditioning system in the Bellevue Stratford Hotel, where it had quietly been growing. Since that date, CDC officials have retroactively blamed previous mysterious epidemics all around the country on Legionella and continue to pin many periodic but small epidemics of flu-like pneumonias on the germ. But simply finding another germ in such victims cannot tell a scientist whether that microbe actually causes the disease or whether it may simply be one of the many harmless microorganisms found in humans and animals. One microbiologist has stated the point that such germs can always be secondary invaders, opportunists that take advantage of a weak person's decreased resistance rather than causing the weakness in the first place. The opportunistic microbe defines the diagnostic disease, but did not cause the immunodeficiency that allowed it to take over its victim. As heard throughout this chapter, the only logical standards of proof for causation are Koch's postulates. Legionella fails the test. The first postulate states the germ must be found in all cases of the disease and must be multiplying actively enough in the appropriate tissues to explain the symptoms. But even among the Legionnaires struck in the 1976 outbreak, 10% of the victims were never infected by the bacterium. In other pneumonia epidemics, the percentage of sick people positive for the germ has ranged from 1% to this example of 90%. Even these figures may be high, since other bacteria can mimic Legionella in the laboratory tests. Since CDC scientists often do not think to exclude other bacteria, limited testing for other bacteria may have inflated the frequency of Legionella infections. Koch's second postulate proved to be difficult to meet in those victims who have been infected by the original germ. The microbe appears to be so inactive in the body that it cannot be found in the saliva or mucus. It is indeed hard to culture at all, even from the lung tissue it infects. Koch's third postulate requires the germ to duplicate the sickness in a newly infected host, usually an animal. Legionella will cause some symptoms or even death if injected in large amounts, but only in guinea pigs. While the germ also successfully infects and grows in hamsters and rats, it does not cause serious disease in them. The microbe even seems to have a hard time making the guinea pigs ill, since many cultures of the bacteria fail this experiment. CDC experts admit the symptoms of Legionnaire's disease are easily confused with other types of pneumonia, suggesting that perhaps other germs are actually causing the symptoms. This possibility now stands confirmed, since many antibiotics that kill Legionella in the lab culture dish do not cure the disease in humans, while many that work in humans cannot kill the bacteria in culture. These latter antibiotics must be killing other microbes in the body. The evidence indicates Legionella is actually quite harmless. Since 1976, CDC and public health investigators have found the bacteria all over the country, in water cooling towers, condensers, shower heads, faucets, humidifiers, whirlpools, swimming pools, and even hot water tanks, assorted plumbing, mud, and lakes. The bacterium is so universal that between 10% and 30% of the American population has already been infected, yet virtually no one ever develops Legionnaire's disease symptoms. Even laboratories testing for this bacterium find problems because Legionella frequently contaminates the experiments from the surrounding air. Thus, the CDC should have dropped Legionella and searched for other causes long ago. Pneumonias are often caused by microbes already living in the body, rather than new ones infecting from the environment. The body contains many potentially harmful germs that rarely, if ever, cause illness until the immune system becomes weak for some other reason. Legionnaire's disease was probably one example of pneumonia caused by standard germs that take advantage of people whose resistance had been lowered. So what made the Legionnaires susceptible? The CDC has presumed Legionella did all the work, but the first question to ask should be whether the original cause was even contagious. 1 month before the CDC isolated the bacterium, a U.S. House of Representatives investigative committee held hearings excoriating the CDC for not having looked for toxic chemicals as a possible cause of the 1976 epidemic. Chairman John Murphy of New York sharply attacked the investigation because the CDC, for example, did not have a toxicologist present in their initial team of investigators sent to deal with the epidemic. No apparent precautions were taken to deal with the possibility, however remote at the time, that something else might have been the cause. The outbreak certainly did not fit the pattern of infectious epidemics. The CDC itself has openly admitted that none of the afflicted Legionnaires transmitted the disease to anyone else, nor can human-to-human transmission be documented in any other supposed Legionella epidemic. The hotel staff in 1976 experienced none of the disease, nor have any doctors or nurses caring for such patients ever contracted the illness. Conversely, some of the Legionnaires with the disease stayed only in nearby hotels and never spent any time in the Bellevue Stratford. Thus, the disease was not distributed randomly among people exposed to Legionella, as contagion should. The victims, as it turned out, were textbook examples of people at risk for pneumonia. Not just the average Legionnaire, the affected people were heavier smokers, had prior heart and lung conditions, were older, and included several who had received kidney transplants and the accompanying immune suppressive drugs to prevent organ rejection. Because the convention had taken place during the nation's bicentennial, these highly susceptible people also engaged in unusually heavy drinking. The epidemic, such as it was, resulted from the classical risks for pneumonia. Certainly, it presented no public health threat. Representative John Murphy delivered the important lesson. The early investigators of Legionnaire's disease focused so intensely on a biological cause, upon a virus, fungus, or bacteria, that chemicals and poisons were apparently largely overlooked. Yet the CDC and the sensational media coverage of the small and short-lived outbreak terrified the American public at large, and they continue to do so in various small epidemics every year. Despite what Congressman Murphy called a fiasco, the CDC has recovered politically and continues to hold the official view of Legionella as a public health threat. The first international conference of scientists studying Legionella was held at CDC headquarters in 1978, and a growing number of researchers have earned their salaries producing thousands of papers since that time, creating an entire field of science for studying this modest germ. This deluge of misdirected information has drowned out any public criticism of their flawed hypothesis of infection. The bacteria hunters of the turn of the century failed to grasp the point that vast numbers of harmless microbes exist in the world, and that even potentially pathogenic bacteria only cause life-threatening disease in those whose immune systems are temporarily or chronically impaired. But a scientist who assumes an epidemic to be infectious can always find a harmless, ubiquitous microbe that, whether through occupational exposure or by sheer coincidence, will correlate with the disease. Microbes lived on this planet long before humans. We coexist with a sea of microbes and benefit from many, including those that naturally reside in the human body. Simply finding a microbe is not enough to convict it of causing disease. Koch's postulates must be met. Otherwise, reckless science can obstruct genuine discoveries leading to effective prevention and cure. Ironically, public anxiety about catching a contagious disease actually propels microbe hunting, for desperate people will gratefully provide extraordinary money and power to researchers and public health officials to protect them from microbial epidemics. Scientists with alternative views are pushed aside, for too many non-infectious diseases would put microbe hunters out of business. Better safe than sorry is the ultimate argument of those who warn that any unidentified pathogen is infectious unless proven otherwise. But since the establishment of the germ theory by Koch and Pasteur, the medical establishment has never erred on the side of non-infectious causation of disease. Instead, thousands of lives have been lost by misdirected prevention and treatment of non-infectious diseases with microbial measures and therapies. Bacteria hunting did actually fade for a time, mostly following the disappearance of serious contagious epidemics from the industrial world. But today, microbe hunting has returned in force, searching for viruses as well as bacteria, even though infectious plagues have not returned. The reasons lie in the deep-seated bias for microbial causes of disease and in the explosive growth in funding for biological research, which has built a powerful array of government and private institutions with large vested interests in laboratory medicine and biotechnology. The scientific bureaucracy has become immensely larger, and the techniques for finding microbes incredibly sensitive, allowing even the most minute quantities of inactive germs to be isolated from any diseased patient. The discovery of microbial diseases has become a weekly routine in the scientific press releases, but the rest of the story, that the same microbes are later also found in healthy people, remains hidden in the professional literature. Now follows the story of modern virus hunting and the political infrastructure built around it.